Good afternoon, listeners, and welcome to the Dogs Program. We are the Dogs, the Defence of Government Schools Program.
The Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools, and we're here every Saturday at 12 noon to defend and promote public education. Let's just remind you, that's education that's public in purpose and outcome. Above all, it's public in access. It's open to all children, teachers, employees, etc. And as well as that, we believe that it should be publicly owned and controlled because it's the only one that can be publicly accountable. And for that reason, for all those reasons, we also believe that it's the only one that should be publicly funded.
And there's a hell of a lot going on. Jean's not with us this week, so I'll be taking you through the rest of the program. I'm Dale, and welcome. Let's get right into it. First, I've got an article here by Jane Currow, who is a great public school supporter, talking about the crisis of segregation in Australian schools. This is an article that was in the Saturday paper. The title is "The Segregation Crisis in Schools Funding." In the Albanese government's first term, Education Minister Jason Clare observed that Australia has one of the most segregated education systems in the OECD. What is deeply shocking, though not surprising to anyone who has been following this issue for as long as I have, is that our children are mostly segregated according to social class. No schooling system anywhere in the world is completely equal, but Australia is alone in using education funding to turbocharge the divide between rich and poor. In this respect, we're just beginning to get some competition from America's red states. Australia has used the money of all taxpayers to further advantage some of their children and further disadvantage others. In other words, this country has used that money to create the very thing public education was originally designed to break down, a class system. Clare himself, a product of the public school system, seems to understand the basic inequity now described as baked in to our education system. The Labor Party usually enjoys the support of teachers' unions, whose members turn out for every election to urge voters to back Labor. The support of unions is one reason why Labor has not, as yet, had to resort to seeking out religious cults to staff its booths. Teachers turn out because they hope Labor's heart is in the right place when it comes to equity in schooling. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese sent his son to public schools from kindergarten to year 12. Jason Clare's father was a public school teacher. Tanya Plibersek sent her children to public schools, and I recently spied Chris Bowen quietly attending the New South Wales Proudly Public Awards to see his child receive one. For following their principles with their own children is admirable and, sadly, unusual among our politicians. At least Labor has put a little bit more money into public schools, unlike the Liberal Party, which routinely throws money at already overfunded private ones whenever it's in power. Former Prime Minister Scott Morrison, for example, gave an estimated $10 billion to private schools during his tenure, and nothing much to public ones. Worse, he did this under the guise of need, as transitional funding in line with the landmark 2011 Gonski Review. Clare and Albanese managed to hammer out funding deals with every state in their first term, deals that will eventually bring public schools up to their agreed schooling resource standard. The SRS is simply the amount each school needs to adequately educate its students. Unfortunately, despite every public school, except a handful in the ACT, being underfunded according to its SRS, full funding will not be realised until 2034. This means no kindergartner in a public school today will receive the funding they are entitled to until they are in year 9. Given that Morrison thought nothing of blithely tossing a cool $10 billion to the non-government schools, why must the funding to public schools, the schools with a chronic need, be dribbled out so slowly? And why have public schools been required to jump through various performance-based hoops, such as attendance and school completion rates, before they are deemed to deserve the money? Do you know what private schools must do before they can get their public funding? Even Plymouth Brethren Christian Church schools? Teach the curriculum and obey the law, except when it comes to compulsory voting, it seems. That's the sum total that is asked in return for their increasingly generous public funding. Many private schools now receive as much in public subsidies as the public school down the road enrolling a similar cohort of children, to which, of course, they can also add parents' fees. No wonder even the so-called low-fee private schools are mostly resourced above their agreed SRS, some way, way, way above it. One secondary public school principal put it this way: to reduce inequity, schools really need plentiful, qualified staff, generous funding above schooling resource standard, and a level playing field with non-governments around funding and policy and delivery. The inequity is more profound than simply money. The level playing field quoted above is about much more than dollars and cents. What Australia has done over the past quarter century is create two parallel publicly funded education systems, one with all the rights and one with all the responsibilities. Private schools can be public when it comes to the handing out of public money, but private when it comes to everything else. They can charge any fees they choose, they can open schools wherever they like and refuse to open or choose to close them whenever they like. They can hire and fire whomever they like because they have a statutory exemption to the Anti-Discrimination Act and fight hard not only to hang on to it but to extend it via religious freedom bills. They can refuse to enroll and choose to expel whomever they like, or more pertinently, don't like. They can also, if they want, teach creationism and actively discourage girls from going to university with the help of taxpayers. Surely the very least we can ask in return for public money, as enrolments increase in private schools and the middle classes are hollowed out from public ones, is some reciprocal obligations for the compulsory education of all children. The principle I quoted makes the following suggestions. All schools with government funding should be tied to the same policy, accountability, and benchmarks. Change the funding agreements to all schools in receipt of public money to include compliance, implementation, and accountability for enrollment, behaviour, and inclusion policies equally. Equal funding to all schools based on enrollment and complexity loadings as per the public school loadings. Ensure all schools with public funds are above schooling resource standards. Implement the rule that no school in receipt of public money can charge fees. In practice, this would mean that all schools in receipt of public money must accept in-area enrolments and deal with behavioural issues internally rather than simply expelling troublesome or low-performing students and expecting the public system to pick them up. Every time a private school makes the headlines due to the appalling behaviour of some students, and it happens remarkably regularly, my heart sinks. I know some poor public school already struggling with limited resources and high concentrations of the kids the private schools don't want will have to take them on. Frankly, given how much money they've got and the way they congratulate themselves on their superiority and values, there is no excuse for private schools not to deal with their own difficult kids. Doing any of the above will take some political courage, and I am worried the current government shows few signs of tackling the glaring and basic inequality between Australia's public and private schools. Clare is eking out full funding, but his current big initiative, while it may have some sensible features, seems to be ignoring the equity elephant in the room. He is amalgamating four major educational bodies that manage curriculum, teaching and learning, education research, and educational technology. They will become one big organisation, the Teaching and Learning Commission. He claims this will help with equity. I hope so, but as yet, I'm not sure how. In the meantime, in the face of falling enrolments in New South Wales, the Department of Education is turning to already overstretched, underfunded schools to solve its problems. Public school leaders are told they must increase their market share. How exactly, when you've been asked to compete in anything but free market for the past 25 years with both hands tied behind their back? Moreover, most private schools, thanks to their overfunding, can afford professional marketing departments with a promotional budget. Guess who must do the marketing in public schools? Principals, mostly. As for the promotional budget, I do hope they're not expected to take it from the money allocated to their already underfunded schools. I do not need to be convinced that public schools, despite all the hurdles in their way, continue to punch way above their weight. I went to public schools, sent my children to them, and proudly watched my grandchildren thrive in one today. However, that governments have created completely unfair and skewed market conditions, telling principals and teachers it's their job to fix it, is gobsmacking. Surely asking educators to do the next to impossible on top of the already impossible tasks they face every day is a sure way to chase even more of them out of the system. This problem was not caused by public schools. It was caused by ideologically driven governments, snobbery, greedy churches, anxious parents, and a pusillanimous bureaucracy. There are solutions. They could be implemented. Other countries have managed it perfectly well. All we need is a leader with some guts. And that was Jane Carrow in the Saturday paper. It is incredibly frustrating when you realise that Australian schools systems are unique worldwide in that we fund all comers. We fund the religious schools with your tax dollars. We fund the so-called independent schools, the dependent schools, with your tax dollars. And we fund the public schools with your tax dollars. But guess which system gets the least funding? That would be the public system, because the public system is almost considered to be something of a wastebasket, where it's supposed to be the stopgap. It's supposed to be there for all Australian children. And not only are the dogs fed up with it, but Australians are getting fed up with it. I'm going to pass you over to Andy now to hear more.
Thanks. Australians are fed up with inequity in schools, survey shows, and this was published in The Educator and written by Brett Hennebury on the 29th of September. Australia's education system is the foundation of its democratic and social fabric. However, studies have shown that our school system is one of the most unequal among OECD nations, with student outcomes closely tied to socioeconomic status. Students from disadvantaged backgrounds often attend under-resourced schools, while wealthier students benefit from better facilities and more experienced teachers. Experts have warned that this disparity is perpetuating cycles of disadvantage and undermining the principle of equal opportunity. Between August and September 2025, Mark Morris, the Toowoomba-based founder of Fair School Australia and Schools Gender Equality Agency, SGEA, independently designed and ran a national survey to gauge public opinion on school funding and equity. The survey drew 170 responses and hundreds more online nationwide, mostly from parents, teachers and academics, with the largest share from Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria. The resulting study, titled Fed Up, Public Sentiment on the Australian School System, A Call to Action on Equity, Funding and Reform, reveals significant dissatisfaction with the current structure, particularly regarding equity, funding and the privileges afforded to private schools. Australians call time on inequity. Overall, 88% of survey responses indicate an urgent call to action for systemic change toward a more equitable future for all Australians, while a striking 92% do not believe the Australian school system is fair and equitable. The survey also revealed widespread opposition to the privileged status of private schools. More than 9 in 10, 93%, rejected the notion that private schools should be recognised as charities, while two-thirds, 66%, said they should not receive taxpayer funding at all. Support for prioritising public education was near universal. An overwhelming 95% of respondents said funding of public schools should take precedence over private schools, reflecting growing pressure on governments to address decades of underfunding in the public sector. At the heart of these responses is a powerful statement about national identity. Nearly all, 97%, of Australians said values of equity, fairness and inclusion should apply across all schools, pointing to a strong appetite for reform that ensures every child, regardless of background, has access to a quality education. In a result likely to stir debate, the survey also found the country almost evenly split on whether private schools should exist at all. Just over half, 51%, of respondents said Australia should not have private schools, highlighting the intensity of the discussion around educational privilege and choice. Principals shouldn't accept the status quo. Morris said "fed up" was his attempt at a play on words in relation to the federal, Fed, government's role in driving national system equity, while also reflecting the dissatisfaction reflected in the survey responses. When asked what the survey's results say about the role that principals can play in shaping the national conversation about equity and fairness in education, Morris said they shouldn't simply accept the status quo because it has been a certain way or because change is hard. Principals can use their voice and positional influence to agitate by calling for action to unions, principals' associations, members of parliament, while also helping to educate communities on the reality of the current systemic inequity, Morris told The Educator. Principals can collaborate to agitate and catalyse action within their networks because larger group members can make influencing change easier. Previous initiatives that focused only on funding failed to address the systemic inequity fueled by a foundation of unfair governance, a system that enables societal segregation. Equity needs courage, not more research. Morris acknowledged the survey's limitations, but said the equity case is already well evidenced, adding that what's needed now from school leaders is courage and action. There is a legacy of relying on research and evidence to convince political leaders to change, and there is a legacy of this expert advice being ignored, he said. Australia is a democracy, so highlighting that the majority of the population has an appetite for systemic fairness could help to catalyse change. For statistical significance, a similar survey would require at least 385 responses to draw more confident inferences, Morris said. Data should include responses across the Australian population. And I'm sure were such a study to be held, it would get very much similar results. Back to you.
Thank you so much for that, Andy. We'll take a quick break here on the Dogs and we'll be back after this.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Panoply, panorama, panpipe, pansy. Aha, pansexual, knowing no boundaries of sex or gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan. All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope, only on 3CR 855am digital and 3cr.org.au.
Welcome back to the program. If you've just joined us, we are the Dogs, the Defence of Government Schools program. And now we're going to an article which is quite frustrating for a lot of us, especially those of us who understand how important humanities are. It seems that Australian universities, for quite some time now, have been taking the neoliberal late capitalist idea that if it's not going to get you a job, then it's not worth funding for education. And unfortunately, the humanities are being gutted. This is an article from The Guardian by Caitlin Cassidy. Courses within teaching, languages and media are among hundreds to be slashed across Australian universities. Vice chancellors say they've been forced to restructure, but critics point finger at unaccountable university management. Hundreds of university courses within teaching, languages, archaeology and media are among those being slashed as the tertiary sector pushes back against confused government policies. Almost half of Australia's universities have restructured in the past year, leading to the merging or disbanding of more than 50 schools of study and drastic reductions in course options for students, particularly in the humanities. The University of Wollongong is cutting a string of disciplines, including cultural studies, languages, archaeology, and linguistics, while the University of Tasmania will merge its schools of humanities and social sciences, combine politics and international relations into a single major, and no longer offer German. Southern Cross University is discontinuing undergraduate degrees in contemporary music, art, design and digital media. Australian National University, which on Wednesday said it would announce no further involuntary redundancies as part of its Renew ANU process, has so far proposed merging or shutting the schools of music, sociology, crime and social justice, political science, international relations and public policy. It will also close the Australian National Dictionary Centre, the Humanities Research Centre, the Centre for European Studies, and the ANU School of Music. Its Vice-Chancellor, Professor Genevieve Bell, said the university was facing an incredibly challenging period, adding, "Living outside our means is not a responsible financial position." Guardian analysis, based on data provided by every university bar the ANU, forecasts the total figure of job losses to occur by 2027 at about 2,400 across 15 institutions. About 143,000 people worked in the sector as of 2024, according to the Department of Education, equating to a cut of about 1.6% of the workforce. About 847 staff have already been made redundant nationwide, including 218 at the ANU and 259 at the University of Southern Queensland. The proposed cuts across the sector include up to 400 positions, or a tenth of the workforce, at the University of Technology Sydney, UTS. Last weekend, UTS temporarily paused student enrolments for nearly a fifth of its courses in business, design, engineering and IT, health, law and science, as it pursued $100 million in cost cuts. That followed the release in June by Macquarie University of a draft proposal showing 42 full positions in the Faculty of Arts and 33 in science and engineering would be cut alongside almost 40 mergers and curriculum reductions, discontinuing majors in politics, gender studies, media, and performing arts. A spokesperson for Macquarie said the proposals were in response to long-term challenges shaping higher education, and more detail would be made public soon. The CEO of Universities Australia, Luke Sheehy, said universities were understandably in a difficult financial position because of a decade of successive and consistent changes to policy and funding settings, with research investment falling to a record low. Chronic underfunding and confused policy settings are holding universities back, he said. We've called for increased funding for research, a fairer student funding system that doesn't punish students or universities, growth for our international education sector, and financial support for campus infrastructure. The University of Newcastle needs to save $20.6 million annually, while Charles Sturt University, CSU, has announced it will cut its operating budget by $35 million by the end of 2027. The exact number of job losses at each institution has not been announced. As distressing as this decision is, it should not come as a surprise, the Vice-Chancellor of CSU, Professor René Lyon, said. In recent years, the Australian university sector has been in crisis, jeopardised by needlessly restrictive and unsupportive government policies. Charles Sturt has been hit hard by the loss of international students and has no indication from government that it will receive a fair share. The president of the National Tertiary Education Union, NTEU, Dr. Alison Barnes, said the cuts would have a devastating impact. She said they followed 4,524 redundancies during 2020 and 2021. And that's the end of the article there. It is incredibly frustrating when I think of how valuable my degrees in German language, in world literature, all different types of cultural courses. They've informed a great deal of my entire life and the things that I've been able to contribute to my community and my society with. And to think that they're being stripped bare for the sake of some idea that they're not of any worth it's anathema to me. And I dare say a lot of people who actually consider the humanities to be essential to a functioning, well-rounded, compassionate society. And we here at the Dogs are not the only ones who are concerned with this funding of peculiar religious tenets with your tax dollars. As Jane Caro mentioned earlier about your tax dollars funding the Plymouth Brethren Christian Church schools, even though they don't let women in their church vote, which is kind of against the law in Australia because everyone has a right to vote, the Rationalist Society has had enough as well, and they are asking finally about the charity reforms. Of course, they're talking about reforming the whole idea that these churches deserve charitable status to run their schools, to indoctrinate their children, to indoctrinate and restrict the liberties of girls and women within their sects. Let's hear what the Rationalist Society have to say.
Thanks. RSA questions WA government over department's use of values education propaganda line. And this was published in the Rationalist Society of Australia and written by Cy Gladman on the 23rd of September. The Rationalist Society of Australia has questioned the West Australian government over why its education department's website features a propaganda line that independent and religious schools teach values education, while not mentioning the public system's superior secular values. The state's Department of Education, in presenting the different schooling options on its website, says that the independent and religious school system provides values-based education. Meanwhile, the website does not mention the word values on the equivalent page about public education. In a letter to the Education Minister, Sabine Winton, the RSA noted that many independent and religious schools promoted values including religious-based discrimination, sectarianism, segregation, inequality, and anti-science dogmas. In contrast, public education promotes far superior values such as inclusion, equal opportunity for all, non-discrimination, respect for diversity, pursuit of knowledge and science, wrote RSA Executive Director Cy Gladman. Why is the Department of Education promoting the values education propaganda claim of independent and religious schools while not referring to the superior values education on offer at public schools? This week, the RSA has also written to the West Australian government to ask when it would be delivering on its commitment to remove religious exemptions from the state's Equal Opportunity Act. In October last year, the then Attorney General, John Quigley, told the RSA that a re-elected Cook government would amend the Act in 2025 as part of reforming and narrowing the religious exemptions provided under the EO Act. In response to the Law Reform Commission of Western Australia, LRCWA 2022 review of the Equal Opportunity Act, Mr. Quigley committed to supporting the recommendation to strengthen equal opportunity protections for LGBTQIA plus staff and students in religious schools. The LRCWA recommended that Western Australia follow the Victorian example and restrict discrimination in religious schools to positions where religion is an inherent job requirement. Currently, WA's Equal Opportunity Act allows for discrimination in religious schools where it is done in good faith in order to avoid injury to the religious susceptibilities of adherents of that religion or creed.
Thanks for that, Andy, and thanks to the Rational Society for asking the questions. It is frustrating to think how much religious propaganda is being funded by our tax dollars. But now we're moving into an area that's quite close to the bone for us here at the Dogs. Our wonderful Andy, who is a great contributing member to the Dogs here, is in fact trans non-binary, and it really affects them when they hear about what's happening when religious schools refuse to respect the rights of not only pupils but also staff members. Over to Andy.
Thanks. Non-binary teacher takes Catholic school group to court over refusal to use preferred pronouns. And this was published in The Age on September the 24th and written by Nicole Priestell. A non-binary teacher at a Melbourne Catholic school says they will take a fight to have their preferred pronouns used in the workplace all the way to the High Court. The Teachers Union, which represents 75,000 educators from Australian religious schools, says the case could open the floodgates to gender and sex discrimination disputes around the country. Micah Sanders, a teacher at Sacred Hearts Girl College in Oakley, asked the school 2 years ago to remove the title Mr. and use their preferred pronouns on timetables, emails and correspondence at the school. The Melbourne Archdiocese of Catholic Schools, MACS, intervened and refused the request, the Independent Education Union, IEU, said. Sanders has lodged a dispute at the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal with the backing of the union. But MACS, the largest Catholic employer in the state, deployed a jurisdictional argument, claiming the state legislation that was relied on in the application to VCAT was overridden by federal law, so it could not be heard by the Victorian Tribunal. The state's Equal Opportunity Act protects LGBTQ plus Victorians from discrimination in religious schools, except in limited circumstances considered proportionate. The Federal Labor Party promised before the last election to limit exemptions in the Sex Discrimination Act for faith-based employers that discriminate against school staff. However, the Albanese government has yet to legislate that change, and the broad exemptions for religious schools remain in place. Sanders' case will be heard in October in the Melbourne Magistrates Court, where a decision will be made on whether the state or federal legislation applies. In a statement of claim, Sanders wants an order to stop MACS from any more alleged contraventions of the Equal Opportunity Act and wants compensation for the hurt, humiliation, distress and anxiety they experienced as a consequence. But the union is already preparing for a bigger fight, one which could open the floodgates not just for our members across two states, but across the country for anyone employed by a faith-based organisation, according to Deputy General Secretary Kylie Busk. We came out of that VCAT hearing essentially looking at potentially needing to run something through to the High Court because the constitutional element is really significant. She said uncertainty around the issue of discrimination had been lingering as the federal government had not passed previously proposed legislation. The harm this causes both to staff and to students is undeniable. And it certainly is. And I really hope they get a good outcome with this. Back to you.
Thanks for that, Andy. Yeah, I guess I hear a lot of religious people in the background saying, well, if you don't want your children to go to a school with those type of values, don't send them there. But the fact remains, our tax dollars are paying for those types of values to be indoctrinated. And also, our tax dollars are paying for them to discriminate against staff members. And that's not okay. So if you want to teach those types of, well, I wouldn't call them values, but if you want to teach those type of values, don't do it on our dime. Anyway, that's my rant. Let's have a quick break, shall we?
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
Welcome back to the Dogs program. If you've just joined us, we're the Dogs, the Defence of Government Schools program. And now we're going to pass you on over to Jeff, who's been around the world, and it's scary out there too. What have you got for us this week, Jeff?
Good afternoon, listeners. This week we're going to start in the United States, where there's an article which was linked through the Network for Public Education. This is one by David Pepper. It actually comes from his blog, or his Substack, called davidpepper.substack.com, and it's from September 24th, 25. The title is "A Publicly Funded School System with Zero Accountability to the Public." He says, "I continue to predict that the private school voucher system of Ohio will at some point turn into the biggest scandal in Ohio history, for three reasons. The system's costs have now exploded into the billions of dollars per budget cycle. There is absolutely zero transparency as to how those billions are being spent. We have no idea whatsoever how the institutions receiving these dollars are spending them, or even if they are being spent on education. Ohio is the most corrupt state in the nation, with major scandals exploding every few years, and those are just the ones we know about. And some of the biggest scandals have included the siphoning off of public education dollars, which have been viewed as a piggy bank for those seeking to make a buck. Add those three factors together and you have a recipe for disaster. And it's especially bad when the added costs of vouchers are one of the reasons property taxes are going up everywhere and why public schools remain underfunded. A separate system of publicly funded schools. So given that as a backdrop, let me introduce some data I just reviewed from a treasure trove provided by Andrew Wilson, a former member of the Fairborn School Board and a member of the steering committee of the Vouchers Hurt Ohio, which is a group. Using data from the Ohio's Department of Education and Workforce, DEW, that's Department of Education and Workforce, DEW, he compiled a list of all the private schools receiving funding from the state through two major voucher programs called Ed Choice and Ed Choice Expansion. Note, I use quotation marks because the way the money is framed as vouchers for families, it goes directly from the state to the school. I dug into this data in a few different ways and discovered some eye-popping facts. First, what this data shows is how EdChoice and EdChoice Expansion programs have created essentially a wholly separate system of schools funded by the public, but with zero accountability to the public. Here are the basics. First, 627 private Ohio schools are receiving payments from Ohio through either the EdChoice or EdChoice Expansion programs. That's 85% of the total private schools that the state has in its records as enrolling Ohio students. Of those 627 schools, 124 schools are receiving direct payments from the state for between 80 and 90% of their enrolled students. That's 20% of the total schools getting EdChoice funds from the state, and at a cost of $199 million. That accounts for 26% of the total EdChoice costs. Several years ago, I wrote about a letter from a school administrator urging families to apply for the gift of the voucher or be required to have a meeting with the school. That effort succeeded in getting 81% of the families to sign up. 259 schools, that's 41%, are receiving payments from the state for between 90 and 100% of their enrolled students. These schools are together receiving more than $388 million from the state, which is more than 50% of the total cost of the EdChoice program. 113 schools, that's 18%, are receiving payments from the state for 100% of their enrolled students. These schools are together receiving more than $100 million from the state. Do you see the issue here? This isn't just a program of subsidising the tuition of some students. It's basically an entire system whereby the state provides public money directly for the overwhelming majority of students at these private schools. Specifically, 79% of the schools receiving state payments and 89% of the total EdChoice dollars are going to schools on behalf of 80% or more of the students. The state is allocating just under $5,500 per student on average for these payments. For many schools, that means the state is paying for the entire tuition of students. That takes the total cost of these 496 80% schools to more than $690 million in 1 year, and the payments are averaging $1.39 million per school across those 496 schools. The bottom line is that this is a second and separate system of state-funded schools where virtually every student, there are no longer income nor geographic limits, triggers public payments to the private school. In many districts and schools, that $5,500 in state funding covers the entire tuition for the student. In other districts and schools, it exceeds what the state pays per public school students in the same community. Zero transparency. Now, some Ohioans believe that it's okay for private schools to get public money. Perhaps others are okay with it happening at this scale. Referenda around the country, including last year's in Kentucky, show that this tends to be the minority. The Kentucky referendum is to introduce vouchers lost in every single county. But put that argument aside for a moment. At the very least, we can at least all agree that public program that supports 93% of the students at 496 schools to the tune of $690 million in public dollars and growing should at least be something we can scrutinise to make sure the public dollars are doing what they're supposed to, or that we even know what they are doing at all. Right now, we have no idea what any of these dollars are doing. Again, a true recipe for disaster. Red flag overpaying. There's one other initial finding that came out of my look at the data. Even though the payment of public money goes directly to the school, it has always been framed as helping families pay for the cost of tuition to these schools. The Ohio's Department of Education and Workforce, DEW, adopts this frame in its rules and guidelines. The EdChoice expansion description is as follows. The scholarship must be used towards tuition to attend participating private schools. The scholarship amount can only be used towards tuition. The EdChoice description spells out the same. EdChoice will either pay the scholarship amount or the private school's actual tuition amount, whichever is less. The rule, voucher is equal to or greater than tuition. Got it? And remember how I said that many schools and students, the state is paying for the entire tuition of students? Well, a close look at the school-by-school Ohio DEW data above and comparing it to the publicly available data on private school tuition shows that the state's payment does not appear to be limited to tuition actually charged by the school. There are a number of schools whose tuition is publicly reported to be somewhere in the $1,500 to $4,500 range, but the Ohio DEW data reports that those same schools receive both between $5,000 and $6,000 per student from the state. If that publicly presented data is correct, the so-called voucher payment appears to be almost twice as large as the tuition for that school, counter to the very rules laid out by the state. And when that number is multiplied across hundreds or dozens and hundreds of many students, that would be no small mistake. Just glancing at a few schools, they're bringing in tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or even millions in added revenue from the difference between tuition they charge and the higher amount they're receiving from the state for their students. And just at a look at just 15 schools shows that the potential overpayments totaled more than $6 million for those schools alone. Perhaps there's an explanation for what appears to be a major issue. Maybe the data they're reporting is simply not accurate, but of course that would be its own problem. But if not, has DEW been paying schools without actually looking at the tuition levels of each school? And then the question becomes, if schools are taking in this much money above what they charge students for tuition, where is this extra public money going? And if they're now tempted to resolve this discrepancy by hiking tuition to equal the voucher amount, is there any rule that stops them from doing so? And bigger than all that, the fact that even my cursory look at the data public revealed such a potentially dramatic red flag is the reason that transparency is so desperately needed in all of this. On these and many other questions, we need answers. So that's the end of the article. And it just shows what happens when private systems take over public funding and transparency seems to go out the window in the US. So that is their experience, and I wonder how that would relate to an Australian public schools, private school system split with the money increasingly going to private schools without any scrutiny at all. Okay, we're going to go to a short article from the Humanist UK now. This came out on their website on the 26th of September, 25, and it is written by... doesn't say, actually, I'm sorry. It is an article by the Humanists UK. I'll just leave it at that. It's from the 26th of September, 2025. UK government accepts and supports state school race discrimination. And it begins, a High Court judgment has found that faith-based admissions in state schools can result in indirect race discrimination, highlighting long-standing concerns from Humanists UK that religious selection leads to ethnic and social segregation in schools. In the case concerning Twyford School, Church of England High School, Mr. Justice Bourne accepted that faith-based oversubscription criteria can have a disparate impact between racial and ethnic groups, even where the policy's stated aim is religious rather than racial. The Secretary of State for Education, who intervened in the case, accepted it would not be surprising if faith-based oversubscription criteria disadvantaged certain racial groups. The court also recorded acknowledgements from the school's trust and the Office of Schools Adjudicator that such criteria will almost always disadvantage one group compared to another. Humanists UK, which campaigns for single admissions code with no provision or discrimination on grounds of religion or belief, says the ruling should prompt government ministers to examine how faith-based admissions can result in segregation. Analysis by Humanists UK found that ethnic integration into schools improved significantly as a result of the cap. Humanists UK has also called for the 50% faith cap, which is applied to faith-free schools, to be extended to any new faith school allowed to open under the provisions of the Children's Wellbeing and Schools Bill. Without a cap, 100% religiously selective schools will be able to open under proposed measures in the bill, and Humanists UK has been working with parliamentarians to propose an amendment for extending the cap to the bill. In a recent debate in the House of Lords, members of the all-party parliamentary Humanist group made a strong case for the cap to be applied to promote community cohesion. Humanist UK's education campaigns manager, Lewis Young, said, "It's shocking to see, set down in black and white, that the government accepts that state schools are discriminating on racial grounds and that the government seemingly supports that. No child should be turned away from their local school because their parents are of the wrong or no religion. The government should be working to create an admission system that is fair for everyone, not entrenching segregation further in society." And that's the end of that short article. With that in mind, though, this is an article by the National Secular Society, and likewise, it's tackling the same article, the same issue. National Secular article is also not attributed to a name, but it is the National Secular Society's article from the Friday the 26th of September 2025. This is regarding a Jewish school in England which receives government money. And the article is, "Faith school which bans women wearing trousers becomes state funded." The article begins, "Independent Jewish school which asks families if they purify utensils acquired from non-Jews converts to state-funded school." The National Secular Society has expressed alarm that a London faith school which bans women from wearing trousers and penalises families who attend non-kosher restaurants will now be funded by the state. Nancy Rubin Primary School reopened as a voluntarily aided VA state school this month after operating as an independent school for 26 years. Its decision to join the state sector follows the government's move to charge VAT or on independent school fees. Nancy Rubin previously charged parents £1,879 per term. As a voluntary aided school, VA school, Nancy Rubin can select all pupils based on their parents' religiosity when oversubscribed. The school's conversion to a VA school was supported by Barnet Council. The school says it takes great pride in the diversity of our pupils, Ashkenazi and Sephardi backgrounds. The NSS has called the school's conversion a regressive move. Women may not wear trousers, miniskirts, shorts, low necklines or sleeveless tops. The school's dress code for parents and visitors says men must have their head covered at all times and women must wear skirts of knee length, a maximum of 2 inches above the knee is acceptable. It says trousers may not be worn by women. Additionally, women must cover their underarms and may not wear cap sleeves. Women may not wear clothes with necklines lower than 4 fingers from the collarbone, either the front or back of the garment. Trousers are permitted for au pairs and nannies, but they may not wear miniskirts, shorts, plunging necklines or sleeveless tops. The dress code also states fathers are expected to attend Shabbat services at a synagogue and regular Shurim Torah study. The school's uniform policy says boys must wear a tzitzit, which are prayer tassels, and a school kippah, skull cap, and their hairstyles must be appropriate for the school ethos. Parents asked if they purify utensils acquired from non-Jews. Nancy Rubin gives priority to children from parents who can answer yes to questions in a supplementary information form submitted when they apply. The form asks parents to confirm they eat only food which is kosher as defined in accordance with Orthodox Jewish law and eat only in restaurants that are supervised by an Orthodox Jewish kashrut authority. Parents must also observe Shabbat, which usually means refraining from work, attend prayer services 3 times a week, and devote at least 4 hours a month to studying Jewish scripture or doing voluntary work within the Jewish community. The form asks also that parents, if they perform Teviat Kelim, as required by Jewish law. Teviat Kelim is the practice of purifying certain types of culinary utensils in a ritual bath if they were acquired from a non-Jew. The form says, it's expected that families are consistently observant of the Shulchan Aruch, including in relation to ritual honesty and integrity in interpersonal and financial matters. The form must be signed by a rabbi and confirm its accuracy. In 2023, NSS research revealed how schools which place rules on how families spend their private lives, including what and where they eat, may be subjecting those families to coercive control. The previous government told the NSS it would consider these findings as part of its next review of school admissions. NSS school is highly unsuitable for state sector. NSS head of campaigns Megan Manson said schools funded by the state should aim to serve the whole community. This school, which enforces a sexist religious dress code and expects parents to obey religious diets and purify utensils acquired from non-Jews, clearly doesn't do that. It is a highly unsuitable school for the state sector and should never have been granted voluntary aided status. If the aim of charging VAT to independent school fees was to increase public funds, it's difficult to see how requiring taxpayers to pay for a new school which excludes their children will do that. Opening new state faith-funded faith schools is a regressive move at a time when we need to be bringing our diverse communities together. Faith schools simply add to division and segregation between families of different religions and beliefs. And that's the end of the article. And I think it dovetails nicely in with what the humanists were saying. How religion, once you let religion into teaching, there should be no connection between government money and the school itself, I believe, anyway, and so do many of us at the Dogs. And with those updates, I'm going to send you back to the headquarters of the Dogs and wish you a very, very nice weekend. Cheerio.
Wow, thank you so much for that, Jeff. That's enough of the doom and gloom. Let's move on to our good news story every week, our great state school of the week.
Every week on the Dogs program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week. State school.
School of the week.
Great state schools.
State schools. School of the week. School for the week here on the Dogs program.
And this week's great state school of the week is Birchip Peter 12 School. Birchip is a town in the Mallee region of Victoria, Australia, on the Sunraysia Highway north of Donald. The Birchip Peter 12 School is a state foundation to Year 12 school with approximately 180 students and 40 teachers and support staff. With excellent facilities and dedicated teaching and support staff, the school offers a diverse range of programs to ensure students achieve academic, personal and vocational success. From sport and music to hospitality and engineering, there are opportunities for every student to learn in a safe and nurturing environment. The newsletter from this school outlines the many and varied activities enjoyed by the children at this school. For example, primary excursion to Horsham on Tuesday the 9th of September. our Prep to Grade 6 students set off on an exciting excursion to Horsham. Along the way, buses stopped at the Warracknabeel Fauna Park, where students stretched their legs, enjoyed fresh fruit and observed the variety of animals, before continuing on to Horsham Town Hall. The Prep to Grade 2 students attended the first session, watching Someone in the Dark, an interactive play about the journey of a mallee fowl chick from the safety of its egg into the wider world. Students were captivated as they joined in with the puppeteers through the story's many twists and turns. Meanwhile, the grade 3 to 6 students visited the art gallery workshop, completing an I Spy activity booklet based on the exhibitions and enjoying a performance. Later, the groups swapped so that all students experienced both sessions, followed by a lunch and some physical activity before heading home to Birchip. A big thank you to all staff who supported on the day and to Mr. Beasley for his efforts in organising such a valuable opportunity for our primary students to enjoy a cultural and creative experience. And now some facts and figures from the My School website. Current enrolment, 172. And the ICSEA value is below average at 985, representative of a diverse country community. The upper 25% of parental incomes makes up 9% of students. 23% of students have parents in the second level of incomes, and the third quartile, i.e. below 50%, 32% of students. And in the lowest quartile of parental incomes, 36% of students, with 6% speaking a language other than English and 3% Indigenous students. The finances, recurrent grants from the Australian Government of $1 million and the Victorian Government of $3.9 million. Private fees and contributions add another $141,000, and other private contributions another $176,000. And that works out at $30,593 per pupil. And the capital, $225,663 over 3 years. This is a school doing an amazing job on very meagre funding.
Congratulations to Birchip P-12 College. You are our great state school of the week. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. I'll have to sign off now, but I say thank you to Jeff and Andy, and Jean will be back with us next week. If you'd like to find out more about the dogs, you can go to our website at www.adogs.info, www.adogs.info. But from all of us here at the Dogs, it's bye for now.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find Joe Hill. It's there you'll find Joe Hill. I dreamed I saw Joey last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au and thanks for your support.